This program was produced at and first aired on MPR, Manawatu People's Radio, with support from New Zealand On Air. Ka pai, irirangi tamotu, MPR. If you're enjoying this podcast in Manawatu, you could make your very own, just like this one. MPR exists to help people like you tell your story or share your passion on air and online. Check out mpr.nz for more information.
Welcome to Manawatu Conversations, recollections of the past and sometimes opinions about the future. Today we have with us
Roy Brock,
Judy Standish,
and I'm Stuart Burks. Okay, now Roy, you've had a very interesting career, not just in New Zealand, but you also spent time in, was it in Malaya and in Sarawak?
Yeah.
Yeah, and what were you doing in those places?
Well, in Malaya, I was lucky enough to be seconded to the 1st 1NZ Regiment in 1959 for a period, for a training period. There were 12 New Zealand territorial officers and 12 NCOs who were seconded for special training. And it was really to give me give us operational experience. At that stage, up until then, in the territorials, the bulk of the NCOs and officers had been World War II people, but those people were starting to retire, and they wanted people with experience to take over from them. So therefore, they had tried this system out of seconding some of territorial people to Malaya for training and operational experience with the battalion. Now, the battalion was based at that stage in Taiping, which is in North Malaya. Now, we travelled over there. It took a 3-day trip to get that to get there. We flew the first stage. We flew from Whenuapai to Amberley outside of Brisbane, and then we flew over to Darwin, and then we flew the third step. We flew to Singapore, and then we had a day or two there, and we were very lucky. We were shown around various military installations and things like that, and received a brief from headquarters there. Which was the Far East headquarters. We received a brief on what had been happening at that stage. The terrorism in Malaya was coming towards an end.
So the event, the Binsa, was it a sort of communist insurgency in Malaya?
Well, of course, during the Second World War, we've got to go back to then, the main group opposed to the Japanese were actually the Chinese communists. And these people were received arms from the British and that kind of thing. And when the war finished, instead of handing the arms and that in, a lot of the arms and things were actually hidden. And then in 1948 there was a revolt, and an emergency was declared, and that emergency went from 1948 till 1950. And initially, the communists had to top. Initially, the communists actually were difficult to handle at that stage, because it was something that the British weren't used to, and they had to, and they only had the police there and a few units, army units that. And some of those army units were poorly trained in that kind of thing. So initially they were on the back foot, and the communists had an upper hand. And what they would do, they would attack tin miners and appear in a tin mine and murder some of the Europeans and that kind of thing, and also in the rubber plantations and things like that. And they would actually damage the rubber trees, and and intimidate. The main thing was intimidation. They intimidated the locals, and they were made to pay with food and all that kind of thing, and that's how they were supported. Now, that went on for several years, and the police and that, they had the police field force was increased, of course, and more troops were brought in, and they became better trained and that kind of thing. But they were still a very powerful force, the terrorists. They actually murdered the governor, ambushed his vehicle and murdered the governor, actually, of Malaya. Mm. And the first of the other non-British troops were actually the Fijians. A Fijian battalion was sent there, and they were fairly successful, actually, with their operations and that kind of thing. Mm. Then later on, there was quite a number of Gurkha regiments there too, and the New Zealand first had their SAS, went there in 1955. We were the first lot of New Zealand troops to be deployed, was the New Zealand SAS. And they were deployed there at the end of 1955. Came back in 57. And in 57, one NZ regiment went to Malaya. And that's the regiment was there when we arrived.
Yeah.
And yes, and we were, we did all kinds of, after operation, we did several, a major operation. We went up and quite a, up towards the Thai border, actually, at that stage. The terrorists tended to go back over the Thai border because they were, most of them had been almost driven out of Malaya.
Mm.
And
so Malaya was still under the British then? They hadn't been
No, Malaya got independence. Malaya got independence in 1958 or 57. Malaya became independent.
Hmm.
And of course that, that was after the regiment arrived, it actually after one NZ regiment arrived, or one battalion arrived, they actually got independence. Mm. I think it was...
Okay. So you were still helping them fight the insurgents. And you said, so you went up to the border. What sort of operation was it? Were you in armoured vehicles or tanks
on foot? You're on foot. You're on foot. Just
okay. So it's just small groups on patrol?
Patrolling through and staying out there. And each week you get resupplied by air.
Yeah.
And you'd have to get a clearing and you'd have to, sometimes you actually had to make a bit of a clearing actually and you get resupplied by air. We were lucky, we did the last major operation that the battalion did actually. Mm. We were involved with that.
Yeah.
And that gave us that experience.
Yeah. So you encountered any of the insurgents?
No, we didn't know.
No.
At that stage, there were very few and far between.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah, they were, even the previous 2 years, they'd only been involved with, they'd captured several and that, and they'd had killed several, but not a large number, actually, at that stage.
Yeah. So what was it like? Was it just a very difficult terrain to go through and very...
It was very much like, reminded me very much of New Zealand bush, actually.
Okay.
And that's why New Zealand soldiers felt fairly much at home in Malaya, because in the bush, in the jungle there, the conditions were very much the same as in New Zealand bush.
Oh. So, and you'd use bushcraft and so on for sort of plant timing?
Yeah. Mm. No, it was, and those days, once upon a time, they would have slept on the ground when at night and that. But at the stage we were there, we slept in hammocks, slung between two trees, and the hammocks were made with parachutes from parachutes we cut up, supply parachutes we cut up, and made them into hammocks, and they were silk.
Yeah.
And we. And one night we were there, and all of a sudden there was a terrible scream. We were in bed asleep, and there was a terrible scream. And what happened, a branch had come down, and luckily it hadn't hit the person in the hammock, but it hit the rope at the end and thrown him out. And, But one of the big important things that the colonel said was one of the most important things at that stage in Malaya was hearts and minds. Mm. And hearts and minds was mixing with the locals and that kind of thing, and all kinds of activities and that kind of thing. Mm. And the bands and things were part of that, and sports and all those kind of things and that. And that's the reason why probably they were successful in Malaya, whereas they weren't successful in Vietnam. Of course, was a much larger thing. Mm. But the bulk of the people in Malaya were on the side of the troops and that kind of thing. Mm. They didn't see them as enemies. They saw them as
So there hadn't been a need, say, to move a lot of the population to safe areas.
Now, what happened? Now, this was one of the major things I should have covered early in the piece. Mm. After about 2 or 3 years, they realised there was only one way to stop because during the war and the occupation, when the Japs were there, a lot of the Chinese had actually moved out into the jungle areas and cleared areas to farm, you know, to grow crops and bits and pieces and things like that. And after the war finished, of course, they were still doing that. Now, they were easy prey for the terrorists. So what happened, they built these new villages all around Malaya, lots of them, new villages. And these new villages were built all these houses, as I say, I call it a village. Mm. The people were moved into them, and there was two lots of wire around the village. There was an inner and an outer wall of wire, and so that the main reason was that, you know, to protect them from the terrorists, and also so they couldn't throw anything over the terrorists. And you only had one gate coming into the village, and that, of course, you had. They were police or soldiers were there, and the camp I was with for a while. We were attached to one of those villages. We had a wired in the area at the end, and when you went out each day, we used to pick up a weapon of the arms coat, which was near the gate, which was a place where all the arms were stored. You'd pick up your weapon and some ammunition.
So you wouldn't have the weapon with you when you're in case there was a sudden attack over the...
No, not when once you were that stage. Okay. You handed in your weapon when you went through into the protected area. You handed in your weapon. But when you went out, you picked up the weapon. Mm. And some ammunition when you went out. Mm. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But the emergency ended in the following year, actually in 1960. Mm. Actually, the emergency ended. Mm. But it was interesting. Mm. It was a great experience, really.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yes, I think 1957 is when Malaya got independence.
Okay. And then you were in Sarawak for a while, sometime later.
Well, when I was in Sarawak, I went to Sarawak as a Colombo Plan person. Mm. Now, the Colombo Plan was the idea of Colombo Plan was to pick up various experts and to send them to these various new developing countries. And Malaya actually had a university in one of the departments in the university. I think it was the agricultural department, I think, in Kuala Lumpur, was funded through Colombo Plan, and staffed the Colombo Plan. And now there were quite a lot of people were sort of classed as experts. There was educationalists. Mm. There was dental nurses, believe it or believe it not, were dental nurses. Mm. There were, let's have a look, what else do we have, dental nurses? Agriculturalists, all kinds of different agriculturalists were there. And New Zealand sent some dental nurses, and they sent people in the agricultural field, and they also sent educational people. Now, in Sarawak, I went there in 1966. They had two secondary inspectors who were New Zealanders, Colombo Plan, and they had two PEMS people, primary English medium syllabus people, and I was one of those. And what was happening at that stage, they were introducing a new syllabus for the year one to year standard four would be equivalent to it in New Zealand.
Yes.
Year six.
Yes, oh yeah, junior one, junior two, standard one, two, three, and four. Oh, year six.
They weren't classed, as year one, year two, year three, year six, and then they went to... And they went to secondary school, and they what was happening though, there were people preparing the new syllabus, but it had to be tested in the schools, and the teachers had to be taught how to implement it.
Yeah.
And output job was to go around and check and see what was happening in the schools, how successful it was, and run courses for in some cases for teachers if they were having problems, and also to go back to the people, two people who were actually preparing the new syllabus. Now the people who were preparing the new syllabus were Colombo Plan people. There was an Australian chap and a Canadian chap who were doing that. And
so they were writing the textbooks, or they were using...
Well, at that stage, they did all cycle-style stuff before they put it into textbook form. That was the idea. Mm. After it had been tested, it would be put into textbook type things. So it was all cycle-style stuff we used. Mm. Now, one of the things we had, there were a huge number of American Peace Corps people in Malaya at that, and Sarawak at that stage, and they were excellent people, and the Peace Corps people, they were all had a bachelor's degree in most cases, the odd one with a master's degree. But what happened once they'd done time in the Peace Corps, I think they might have got some payment or something towards getting their master's degree. They went back, but they all had to most of them had bachelor's degrees, and they lived in the villages with the with the teachers, so they were right on hand, and they were able to help them and understand the new syllabus and prepare materials, all kinds of materials. And also because they came from America, they were able to get all kinds of old textbooks and manuals and magazines and things, so they could cut out pictures and things like that. They were fantastic like that, and I didn't find one who I could complain about. They were fantastic, the ones I worked with. And it was
all quite young then? Was it sort of like military service age or after that? Or?
They were all, you know, one of the things, there weren't many males, but the males that were there, of course, they didn't have to go to Vietnam if they were Peace Corps people either.
Yeah,
okay. And one of them was a Japanese boy, Willie Higa. He came from Hawaii. But as well as having someone from Hawaii, I also had a woman who came from Alaska. But they came from all parts of New Zealand, from America. Yeah. Now, one of the funny things that happened, I would meet some of them and say, oh, whereabouts are you from? And they would say, oh, I'd say, oh, yes, that's the Corn Belt or whatever it was. Mm. And they'd sort of look at me and say, you know, how the hell do you know? I said, look, that used to be part of our studies when I was, we looked outwards. That's the big difference between Americans and us. We look outwards, they look inwards.
And
that's what I found with them. And they were quite surprised that I knew so much about America.
Okay. Did you find that your earlier time in Malaya was helpful for you in Sarawak?
Well, not a lot, because I was mainly with servicemen in Malaya.
Okay.
I was mainly with servicemen and that kind of thing. I mean, it gave me an idea of what things were like. But, I mean, I didn't see any of the schools in Malaya while I was there, that kind of thing. So it didn't really help very much.
Okay. And even, I suppose, ethnically, to be more Malays in Malaya and then other different groups in Sarawak, were they?
Now, in Sarawak, of course, you had, they had this, the schools. They had morning schools, and a lot of the schools had morning and afternoon classes. So one teacher had half the classroom to put stuff up on, and the other teacher had the other half of the classroom.
Yeah, because so pupils would either start school at something like 7 in the morning and finish at lunchtime or start at lunchtime.
Then the next group would come in.
Because then you need fewer buildings for the same population.
Yeah, it was good. We utilised the buildings well, that's one thing. No, it's... quite a lot of the teachers came to New Zealand for short courses and things too, and just like a lot of people in Sarawak, we had what we called the Sansa group, and they were all the people that had been to Australia or New Zealand. We used sort of a social club we had, and of course the Colombo Plan were part of that too, and there were all kinds of people in Sarawak, actually locals, who had actually... done some had been on council things and all kinds of short courses and that kind. Of course, then there was a few that had graduates too that had been to university in New Zealand.
So was it mainly in Sarawak? There's a lot of the local part, the local native population, like the Dayak and Ahim Malano and so on, different levels than the Chinese groups in there and so on. So. Were you based in one place, or you were moving around and visiting the schools and so on?
Of course, in the schools there was the education office. In the education office there were Dayak officers, there were Chinese officers, Malay officers. Where I was, of course, further north would have
been.
Were
you in Kuching, or were you based in Kuching?
In Kuching, because I was in Kuching.
Which
was the capital.
Yeah.
And, so we had, of course, you had the land Dayaks and the sea Dayaks. And you had the Malays.
And they were in longhouses, where they were living in longhouses?
Yes, it was...
You travelled out to places too, didn't you?
What was that?
You travelled out to places as well.
Yes, you used to quite a lot of the places in the first division I could travel on a motorbike to. You couldn't go on, there wasn't a road, there was usually a track. But also you had to travel by boat a lot, and I sometimes travelled with the police and things like that. Because at that stage, in the first part of our stage in Malaya and Sarawak, there was an emergency in Sarawak. Confrontation with Indonesia, and Kuching's only 22 miles from the actual border. It's only 20, and you could actually sometimes hear gunfire and that kind of thing at night there. I used to sometimes travel with the police and to various places. Well, they weren't the police, they were special police that were recruited during the confrontation. They were the field force people, and they were the ones that went into the field, and you had the normal police who worked in the towns and things like that, and you had the field force people that got out among the villages and things and on the border and that kind of thing. And I used to sometimes travel with field force people that get a ride on a boat and that to go somewhere and that kind of thing.
And you were there as well, were you, Judy?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it was do 8 you, and 9. I think it was 8 and 9. I must have turned 10 when I came back.
Oh, yeah. Okay. Mm. So do you have memories of it?
Yes.
Yeah.
Good memories. We enjoyed it. We had a lot of freedom there.
Yeah. And all the fruits and things, too. Were you eating all those jungle fruits?
Durians.
Durian, yes. Durian, yeah. Ah, oh, but fresh rambutan off the trees. That's
rambutans are nice, rambutans. Bananas, plenty of bananas, plenty of pineapples. And when you got a pineapple, we had a little garden outside our house, and we'd cut the top off the pineapple and we'd plant that in the garden, just put it down in the garden, because it would grow again.
Yeah.
And,
Oh, and the coconut. Now, that was an experience for me in England. Coconut is just in the dried up thing with all the thick flesh inside, whereas coconut there, there's a thin layer of soft, juicy flesh and lots of coconut milk inside.
It's lovely, tastes beautiful.
Very different.
Yeah. One of the things I noticed, though, between the difference between Malaya and Sarawak was the lack of animal life in Sarawak compared with Malaya. In Malaya, we used to see lots of snakes and things like that, lots of monkeys and that kind of thing. And the thing was, in Borneo, you didn't see a lot of that kind of thing, monkeys, did you, Judith?
Yeah, I don't remember. No.
You see monkeys?
I don't remember. No. Yeah. At least the one in the jungle.
You didn't see. Yeah. When I was in the army, they were having a shoot. The company was having a shoot at in Ipoh, which is the second city in Malaya. Every soldier has to do an annual shoot and gets marked on their standards. Yeah. And we had to chase, and this was just in the edge of the city, and we had to chase the monkeys away from the butts because they were all around the targets. Oh. We had to chase all these monkeys away before we could start the shooting.
Thank you for listening to Manawatu Conversations. This and other recent programs can also be found on the Manawatu People's Radio website, and a range of programs is also available on the Manawatu Heritage website of the Palmerston North City Archive. The address for that is manawatuheritage.pncc.govt.nz.
If you enjoy this NPR podcast, please consider subscribing. Our podcasts are available on all major podcasting platforms: Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, and Spotify, as well as the accessmedia.nz app. Support this show and others like it by giving a donation. For more information, go to www.npr.nz/donate.